It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll learn about the use of medicinal plants in the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe culture. First, scientists announced today that there are definitive signs of liquid water on present-day Mars. These signs were observed by NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. The source of the water could help scientists find the most promising sites for possible life, past, maybe present, on Mars, and landing spots for human missions of the future. Bill Andrews is with us to talk about the news. He's a senior associate editor of Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Talk us through these definitive signs. We haven't seen the water itself necessarily, so how do we know it's been there?
Right. Well, partly these are things that astronomers had been seeing for years already, so they'd already kind of suspected it might be liquid water. Specifically, these are kind of long, shadowy, tendril-like appearances that have shown up in the edges of craters and cliffs on the surface of Mars. And they look very familiar to, you know, Earth-based geologists who sure thought they looked like, oh, these are damp areas. The soil has grown darker in these, you know, patches. But for years, we didn't know exactly why they had grown darker. It could have been a number of things, and liquid water is interesting, but, you know, a lot of things could have been it. But today, the big announcement from the NASA folks was that they have spectroscopically analyzed the light from these dark areas. So they've looked at the components, the molecular components of what is actually in these spots, and they've found salts that have been hydrated. So it looks like they've found pretty clear evidence that there is current water activity that is pretty much only explained by liquid water appearing on the surface of Mars.
So it's like you sprinkled some ocean water on a sidewalk, let the water evaporate. There's some mineral residue that still shows sign of having been in water?
Right, exactly like that. And I just want to be clear that while it is liquid water that we're talking about, it's still, they like to say, briny. Mm-hmm. So it isn't the kind of thing that you'd want to particularly drink on a hot day. And even though we're saying liquid water on the surface, again, it isn't really like you could take a dip in it or even see it flow. It's more like wet dirt, you know, kind of a damp area. But still, that's more water activity than a lot of people thought we'd ever see on the surface of Mars or the surface of any planet.
We've known, scientists have known, that there's water on Mars in frozen form, polar ice caps on the planet. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to hunt for water in liquid form?
Well, in a word, life. We don't know everything about how life originates and what kind of conditions lead to it. We only have the one planet where we've ever seen it, namely our own. But it sure seems like liquid water is a big part of that. And like I said, we haven't ever seen liquid water on any surface of any world in the solar system. A lot of the moons out there have oceans underneath an icy crust. But on the surface, where we'd have kind of the best view of things, this is the first time we've ever seen anything like that. So it's exciting for just in the solar system kind of stats way, but it's also great because it means that perhaps, maybe, parts of Mars today are habitable. And I don't want to make people think that we have any evidence of that at all, but we have no evidence that that's not the case, which, scientifically speaking, is kind of a big deal.
Talking to Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine about NASA's announcement today of pretty strong signs of, at some point, liquid water in recent Martian history. Mars, as I understand it, Bill, cold place, mm-hmm. So that's why the water's usually frozen when we find it. So does this mean it warmed up enough to thaw, or is it because the water is so briny that the freezing point is different? Why is it liquid in these situations?
Yeah, it's actually a combination of those things. It is partly the heat. We see these things appear in the warmer months on Mars in the spring and summer, and right now we are kind of solidly into spring on Mars. The summer solstice is January 3rd of 2016. So we're heading into prime season for these things. So currently, as we speak, water could be, if not flowing, seeping on Mars. So heat is a part of it. And the other reason that it could exist at all is these salts that we talked about earlier, specifically perchlorates, which we know on Earth, if you salt ice, if you salt water, then it can get a lot colder before it freezes. And the same is true with these perchlorates, but kind of on steroids. So water can get a lot colder, and it can deal with Mars's much thinner atmosphere and still stay in liquid form because of these perchlorate salts in it.
As often happens in science, today's discovery is tomorrow's list of questions. One of those questions is, where would this water be coming from?
And that is a question that the scientists have as well. There's no real answer to that yet, though, of course, being good scientists, they have some hypotheses. And one of the favorites is, it could be, and this is one of my favorite new words I learned today, deliquescence, which is when the ground absorbs water directly from the atmosphere. So even though Mars's atmosphere is so thin, these perchlorates could make the soil kind of latch out and leach out the water from the air. But if that doesn't work, it could be underground ice that astronomers have seen in the areas, have suspected are underground, or maybe unknown but possible salty aquifers that could be kind of leaking, spilling out onto the surface at this point. But again, these are all just ideas. We don't really know where this water is coming from.
Well, we've got these rovers up there in Mars, and I think a lot of people are thinking, hey, let's zip one of those guys over there, test this stuff out. As I understand it, we're very intentionally not parking these rovers where there might be water.
Right. And part of that, I think, comes from a certain reticence of NASA's to address the life on Mars question too directly. In the 60s, when they first sent a mission to go look at the planet, and everyone was excited for life, and all it found was this dead desert landscape. Public interest in space, in Mars, just plummeted. So I think ever since, NASA's been really careful about directly being able to contradict anything that would get people excited. But the other big thing is that these rovers have microbes on them from Earth. So if we sent these things to go look at possibly habitable environments to look for signs of life, let's say, it could be that we end up finding signs of our own life up there. NASA tries very hard to sterilize anything they send into space, but nothing's perfect. So it'd be really a shame to kind of taint what could be a pristine Martian environment with our own microbes.
Yeah, it would be a bummer in 3 years to discover microbes on Mars, and then a couple years after that, realize, oh, nope, we brought them with us.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a pretty big bummer. Some say NASA wouldn't be able to recover from that, so they don't even want to think about it.
Well, you mentioned the possibility of life on Mars maybe existing in microbial form. This is briny water, not the most hospitable environment, so maybe, maybe not. Does this start us thinking about, hey, these are places we could find sources for water for all the people talking about human colonies on Mars?
Yeah, and while, again, it's something that we want to be careful people don't think will happen tomorrow, it is absolutely something that NASA and private spaceflight companies will be taking into consideration. Not just the idea that there are places on Mars where liquid water could flow, seep, exist, which is more than we thought possible years ago, but also the diversity of where these areas are. A lot of what the scientists looked at in today's finding were closer to the equatorial regions. And before, as you'd said, we knew that there was ice, water ice, around the polar regions and the ice caps. But finding it around the equator is that much more hopeful for us to think, well, maybe there's water all over the place. It isn't so much that now Mars will be a great tourist destination, but perhaps it's not quite as deadly as we thought it was, which is always a good thing.
As we wrap up, we've talked about Mars's past and future. Is this an indication of Mars's past when it may have had more water on the surface?
It certainly speaks to the likelihood of being able to find water on the surface, but I think that the question of past liquid water on the surface had been pretty well answered. We knew from other lines of evidence, from other investigations, that there had been lots of literally flowing water, the way we think of water, on the surface of Mars way in the past, deep in the past. And so this is a kind of a different line of evidence that lets us think, yes, maybe today there's still some kind of flowing water on the surface of Mars.
Bill, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That was Bill Andrews, senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. He was with us to break down the news today that scientists have found definitive signs of liquid water on the surface of Mars. Native American cultures have a rich body of knowledge about the natural world and uses for the plants, animals, and minerals within it. Joining us now to talk about the botanical knowledge of the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe people is Mary Sisipe Genius. She's the author of the new book, Plants Have So Much to Give Us, All We Have to Do Is Ask. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you open the book with the story of the year the roses died. It explains why rabbits look why they do, but it also highlights the dangers of overusing resources. Why did you use that story to kick things off?
Ki always did. Ki is my teacher, Kiwetinohkwe, woman of the Northwest Wind. She always loved that story because she said it embodied the way all of creation has to help, has to maintain the balance for any individual species to survive, but also so that we could all survive and the whole system could keep going. And she thought it was a good story for that. That it also shows the how one single plant can affect so many different species all at once.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Ki, the woman who taught you. Can you tell me more about her and the line of knowledge, her teachers, and back to people we don't know anymore?
Oh, sure. I met Kiwetinohkwe in the early 1980s. My children were very young, and I went back to university, and I found Ki there. She was one of those teachers that, if you're very lucky in your life, you get one of them, you know. She was the kind of teacher that changes a person's life, and she changed everything about my life, the way I viewed most all of the rest of it. And, well, first of all, I was her student. I took ethnobotany from her and in Anishinaabe philosophy, and then I became her teaching assistant. And I helped her teach the ethnobotany labs and the philosophy workshops and things. And then I became her Ashkel Bewis, which is a traditionally bound apprentice I was bound for to learn about the herbs and about healing and also about ceremony and life ways.
And she handed so
until she died.
Mary, she handed so much knowledge down to you, and you write that you were trying to get her pretty much to write this book you have written. What was her response to that?
Boy, I really tried. I really tried because I thought it would get me out of the obligation of having to do it. But she always had so many calls on her time. She was such a generous person that she helped community people and, you know, the students. But also she pointed out to me at one point that whether or not she wrote it, I still had the obligation to write down what I had learned from her and also what I had gleaned along the way myself. So that kind of cinched it for me. And I put it off as long as possible because it's kind of a daunting task, you know, until my daughter finally went off to graduate school. And I started getting these telephone calls from her where I could hear her clicking in the background. She'd ask me, you know, Mom, about that, you know, that salve we used to make? How did we actually do that? And I'd tell her, and I could hear her taking notes. And I thought, oh, boy, this is odd. You think when you raise a kid that you've taught them everything that you could possibly teach them, you know, before you send them out in the great world. But I realized that there were probably gaps in what I wanted my own daughters to know, must have been gaps in their education or their memory. And so I decided it was finally time to bite the bullet, to write down what I knew about this sort of thing, so that it would be within my family. And after my daughter got her her PhD and started to work teaching Ojibwe, she came back and insisted that we had to put it into a form. I had already finish the manuscript, but she insisted that we put it into a form that the general public might get some benefit from, that other Anishinaabe people might enjoy reading.
And you say in the title of your book, and you talk about this as you talk about people gathering plants to use as you say, salves or medications for other purposes. Yes. Step one is you ask. You ask the plant for permission to take it, to harvest it and use it. Tell us about that.
Any time we change the balance in the natural world, it is necessary for us to ask permission of the individuals who are being asked to sacrifice themselves for our benefit. And it is Anishinaabe teaching that all beings on this planet have spiritual gifts and physical gifts to share with the rest of creation. And if you ask them for their help, they can give it to you. They can't give it to you unless you ask, which presupposes, of course, that you know that you can actually talk to a rock or you can actually talk to a tree and get help from it.
Talking to Mary Sisip Genius, she's the author of the book, Plants Have So Much to Give Us, All We Have to Do is Ask. She's of Cree and Métis descent. She's taught classes in ethnobiology and American Indian Studies. This book is an encyclopedia of a whole time-bound, time-honored tradition of the use of plants of the Midwest and beyond. And an idea you introduce in the book is that for every problem humankind may have in this life, there's a plant that can help. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. There is a plant that can help in any of our problems. We may not know what the plant is yet, but the plant exists. We may have forgotten what the plant is, but the plant exists. We can always get help from, because someplace in creation, our need has been foreseen, and the answer is out there, and that there is a plant that can help. It's an amazing thought, but we can actually see it. If you start looking, you can actually see it. For instance, the bottom line of all of this, of living a good life, an Anishinaabe Bimadaziwin, which means life in the fullest sense, the best possible way to live on this planet. The bottom line in that is balance. And Creator wove balance into the whole system in the beginning. And if we, in our lives, get out of balance, that's where we start having health problems. We start, our luck changes, not just for ourselves, but our families, those people we love, the people around us, so that all of society gets out of whack. And the answer to that one is a tree. Nokavus Gijik, grandmother cedar, which is the Atlantic or northern white cedar. It's not the one that makes cedar chests, that's juniper. But the cedar tree has, within its growth pattern itself, is the Anishinaabe tree of life. It is the balance that Creator wove into the whole system in the beginning. And we can use cedar to call for help in many different ways, many different medicines that can be that can help a human being who is feeling out of balance.
One thing that struck me about what you quote Key is saying, and you reinforce this yourself, is to be cautious. There's a quote, something like, dead is dead, there's no gray areas. We have to be careful in going out and gathering plants to use as medicines.
Oh, goodness, yes. Key always said that in ethnobotany there was no place for a mistake, because dead is dead and there is no degree of deadness. It always reminded me of, you know, the Wizard of Oz, the Munchkin saying, she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead. It's the idea that you have to know exactly what plant you've got in your hand before you can use it for anything. You've got to be absolutely certain of the identification, because there are out in the natural world plants and fungi that'll kill you dead and real quick too. I mean, it's not like you can't just think you've got the right plant. You have to absolutely know.
And Mary, as we wrap up, you learned so much from Key, Xi, from generations before her. Is there a new generation stepping up to learn these lessons and then pass them down to another generation?
Oh, I hope so. I really do, because many of our Anishinaabe communities are in desperate need of it. I think the whole planet could really use a little balance at this point. I teach myself. I teach at UWM, ethnobotany, 105 in the fall, 106 in the spring. I've written the book. I have Oshkosh Bewis myself. Hopefully they'll be able to do this in the future when I can't do it anymore.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you for calling.
That's
very kind.
That's Mary Saseeb Genius, the author of Plants Have So Much to Give Us, All We Have to Do Is Ask. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. We are in the midst of the first official week of autumn. While some people might be sad to see the summer go, a lot of chefs and foodies are excited by all the culinary opportunities fall has to offer. One of those chefs is Terry Milligan. She just wrote a piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called A Culinary Bucket List for Fall. We're taking your calls, too. What is on your fall culinary must-do list? What seasonal dishes are you excited to make? Me? It's all about the squash. Share your recipes and your fall cooking traditions now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Terry Milligan is a chef, culinary instructor, and food writer. She frequently writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section, and she has a featured quarterly article in the food magazine Edible Door. Terry, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I said I'm all about the squash. Terry, what do you love the most about fall?
Well, squash is one of my favorite things, and it is on my bucket list. But in addition to eating squash, I urge your listeners to also decorate with edible squash so that you can have an edible display, and then at the end of having it displayed, you can cook it.
Yeah,
so you kind of use the whole thing.
I love that. When I have squash around, yeah, I'll often just put it out on the table, little decoration there, and then grab it. When my kids were littler, they used to be unhappy when I murdered the decorative squash or baking pumpkins, though.
But, you know, all pumpkins are squash. Not all squash are what is it? Now I'm getting mixed up. All pumpkins are squash. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So those pumpkins that sometimes you have outside, too, you can sometimes cook with those, too. You just have to kind of do a little research.
Well, I've come up with a lot of ways or come across a lot of ways to cook with squash of whatever sort. What are some of your favorites?
Well, soup is always a favorite, and that knocks a couple of things off my fall bucket list if you make a nice squash soup, because soup's on the bucket list and winter squash. I also like to roast it and put it in salads. I think it's terrific in that, or even just in a stir fry to cut up squash, and you can have them raw, cut up, and like half-inch pieces, put them in the freezer and just pull them out as you want and throw them in a stir-fry in the middle of winter and get some nice color.
You've given me two that I've never done before. My favorite and weirdest is squash waffles or squaffles. I take mashed squash and work them into a waffle batter.
Well, that sounds like a good one I'll have to try.
Sour cream instead of syrup with that.
I've even made muffins with squash. So
that sounds good, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's dig some more into your fall bucket list apple picking. You say you got to do it. Now, don't just go to the store and buy apples. Get out there and pick them. Why is that important?
Well, I think it's for a variety of reasons. One, you know where you're getting them if you're picking them yourself. Two, it's a great family activity. So I live in Door County, and in the August, July time frame, we have cherries to pick, and now we started apple picking. So we see a lot of families coming up here and making apple picking part of their tradition and visiting our county. And there's a lot of places throughout the state that you can pick apples, and on the article that I wrote, there's a link that you can type in and find where there might be an orchard near you that you could pick apples.
Do you have a favorite variety this fall, one you keep coming back to, Terry?
Well, Honeycrisp is one of my favorites. I just, you know, love it, and it works well in both pies and just eating. So they're almost ready to pick Honeycrisp here in Door County. I heard they had another week or so to go before we could start picking those. But that's one of my favorites because it's sweet enough to eat and also firm enough to bake with.
Talking to Terry Milligan, a chef, culinary instructor, food writer, about your fall must-do food items, things you look forward to in the fall, cooking with or maybe letting somebody else cook with and then eating them. We want to know what your favorite fall food is. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Maybe even share a recipe. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's stay with fall fruit now, Terry, and the cranberry, a big Wisconsin tradition. I got to say, I buy them frozen sometimes. I don't really know what to do with them. I don't do much with the cranberries. Talk me into getting some fresh cranberries, I guess, and using them?
Well, you can use fresh. You can use frozen. They're a pretty good fruit that can be used directly from the frozen state. But if you do freeze them, you don't want to thaw the berries. Just make sure you throw them into whatever recipe you're doing in the frozen state. But most recipes, you're going to be able to use frozen. It's not that easy to find fresh unless it's this time of year. But you can use those cranberries again in everything from breakfast items like muffins or waffles or pancakes to desserts, which I do a lovely pie. I have a pie in my Edible Door magazine this quarter that has cranberries as one of the five fruits in it. It's a multi-fruit pie. You can also use it in entrees by making, there's a grilled salmon with dried cranberries that's linked to the to my article, and that's a nice way to use it in an entree form.
What I do a lot with the fruit this time of year, apples, pears, especially bruised ones, is make crisp. If I wanted to work those cranberries into my crisp, say, do I have to add some extra sugar because they're so tart?
Well, usually you don't because you're not putting that many in. So I would say not necessarily. I think it's kind of nice to have a little tart bite with the sweet. So if another way to do it without even, you could use the dried cranberries, which have more sweetness because they're condensed in flavor. So you could use dried cranberries in it as well. But fresh, if the pie recipe that I did, I just put some fresh, maybe a half a cup of fresh cranberries into that total pie just to get some color and some tart flavor.
Well, speaking of pie, I want to get back to squash a little bit now because you shared a recipe with us, butternut squash cheese, not just cheese, goat cheese, I think, and sage. We've got that on the Central Time website right now. Talk us through the butternut squash pie.
Well, what's neat about these pies is I make them individually. So you can make all these little individual pies and give your guests an individual pie to eat, or you can actually freeze them and unbaked and then just pop them in the oven. So it's very easy. You're going to get some peeled and seeded butternut squash along with a little bit of onion, and I usually saute that, but you could steam it as well. And once it's nice and cooked through but still a little firm, you just put it in your food processor. And you make a nice little kind of puree that has a little bit of consistency to it. Roll out your dough. I have some goat cheese is one of my favorite things, so a little softer goat cheese mixed with some fresh sage. Sage is one of the few herbs that might still be in your garden because it's awfully hearty. So you just do your little round piece of pastry, a little bit of that squash. Up on top of that is a little dollop of the cream of the goat creamed goat cheese with sage, and then a little top of pastry on top. You crimp it up, and you've got a hand pie, they're called, because you can fit them in your hand.
This would actually knock off two items from your bucket list, the squash and making a savory pie. Three if we decorated with a squash first. Why is a savory pie an important thing for fall? Because I'll make sweet pies and crisps and cobblers and stuff like that. Why savory?
Well, actually, the origin of pie started with savory pies, way in the back with the Romans. That's what they would use to, it was actually a vessel to kind of put their food in to carry around with them. They'd put it in these savory pies. So it's kind of coming back in vogue to make pie not just for a sweet, but why not have pie for dinner? And you can have pie for dinner by having it as a savory pie. So I like the idea of having something all in one. You have your chicken pot pie, of course, it has a little pastry on top, but you can do a whole lot of things with other pies. There's a neat pie that is in the Edible Door article that a chef up here did. She's from the Republic of Slovakia, and she made a great savory pie with pulled pork and smoked paprika.
That sounds fantastic.
And it had white wine in it, too, so it was really good.
Yum. We're talking to Chef Terry Milligan about her latest piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's called A Culinary Bucket List for Fall. And we're taking your calls, too, about those must-eat foods that we get this time of year in Wisconsin. What are you looking forward to making this fall? What have you been looking forward to? What is your favorite autumn recipe? Is this your favorite time of year to cook and eat? What ingredients are you most excited to cook with? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Chef Terry Milligan now about her piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, A Culinary Bucket List for Fall. Call in now at 800-642-1234 with your to-do list for fall cooking. What are you making this season? What have you been looking forward to all this year? What is your favorite way to cook with apples, squash, root vegetables, cranberries, the stuff we get in fall? What are your favorite autumn recipes? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Terry, another from your bucket list, a canning party.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about canning, not just for its own benefits, but as this social event.
Well, for a canning party is something that I have become involved with throughout the last couple of years. Canning has become more in vogue again. You know, our grandparents and grandmas, they all did the canning, and now everybody has CSAs and has all this produce and needs to do something with it. So canning has become back in vogue. And throwing a canning party is a great way to socialize with your friends as well as share different types of canning recipes. So instead of going home with just 12 things that you made yourself, you can mix and match. So you can go home with 10 or 12 different cans of something because you've done a little rotation. It's kind of like a cookie exchange, but with canning.
And Terry, I'm lazy, A, and not super sociable, B, but based on a show we had done on one of our Food Fridays, I've gotten into doing fridge pickle stuff, which is a lot faster. It doesn't keep as long, of course. You got to keep it refrigerated. Do you do much fridge pickling yourself?
Well, and also refrigerated jams I do a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, jams and freezer jams, too, you can do as well. So a little bit easier for those new people that don't want to get into the whole throng of canning yet. You can start with those, but those are great activities. And again, I think it's fun to do with kids, too.
Let's get to our callers at 800-642-1234. We have Luke on the line in Cross Plains. Luke, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about, Luke?
I love roots. I've been exploring using them over the last month or so. They're great because you can, as long as you have a variety and enough, you can get any kind, you know, parsnips, turnips, potatoes. I love sweet potatoes because they add some good natural sweet flavor. A lot of people don't know, roots are incredibly nutritious.
Mm-hmm.
And, purple sweet potatoes have 3 times the amount of antioxidants as blueberries. So, you know, it's a good filling meal, really a comfort food for the fall.
And Luke, can I ask, what's your favorite way to serve, cook and serve roots?
I like to do roasted roots, and I've been messing around with curry on them. It's actually a really good additional flavor, curry and garlic.
Luke, thank you so much for that call. And that's another bucket list item for you, Terry, cooking with our root vegetables.
And yes, it is. And in fact, there's a great recipe using root vegetables roasted, as your caller talked about, but then putting those roasted roots in a galette, which, of course, is almost like a pie. It's a free-form pie. No, you don't need to have a pie form. It's kind of like a pizza almost. And that's a great way to have the root vegetables as an actual pie for dinner.
Do we give enough respect to, you know, parsnips and turnips? They're such simple things. I think they get rutabagas, too. We just overlook them.
Well, that's why I said one of our items was to rediscover Brussels sprouts, because I think it's one of those vegetables that has gotten a bad rap in the past. And now the kids didn't want to eat the Brussels sprouts. Now there are a variety of really neat recipes to use Brussels sprouts for that are more than just a steamed sprout. They're great raw. Again, very nutritious. And if you happen to be in a farmer's market, you might even find them actually on the stalk, which is really a fun thing to show your kids. Again, where did that Brussels sprout come from?
kids and 40-somethings didn't like their steamed Brussels sprouts, but since I've had them served oven-roasted and made them that way, I love them. They're amazing that way.
And I have a great salad recipe in that article that's used shaved raw Brussels sprouts with apples and pomegranates and walnuts and just a simple vinaigrette. So it's almost like a slaw, but it has a lot of crunch in it because of the apple and the pomegranate.
Talking to Chef Terry Milligan about our favorite autumn foods. You can join in with yours at 800-642-1234. Betty is with us next in Oak Creek. Betty, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am just winding up. I just took my green beans out of my canner. I love to can. It's something that my mom and I did as long as I can remember, because what we had to eat, we were pretty poor, but we had always food, and it was always home canned food and home grown food, because I grew up in a farm, and I just love to can. Hello.
Canning and any favorite other fall produce? Any favorite apples,
yeah,
Betty?
I wanted to say my daughter-in-law. They met us there in Minnesota, and we're in Wisconsin, and we went to Missouri to a family funeral. And she had gone over to her apple orchard there at Prior Lake, and the apple is called a Snow Sweet. Hmm. She said it was a new apple, and was it good?
Wonderful, so Betty. Thank you so much. Yeah, Snow Sweet, that's a new one to me.
Sounds new, yes. There are quite a few new apples that are becoming. It's same with cherries. We had a couple of new cherries that we brought into the county this year.
And I want to get to her first point, Terry, about, canning is a good budget way to eat over time. Once you make that upfront investment in the canner and some jars, you can keep that fresh produce and have it through the winter and beyond.
You certainly can, and as your caller said, you have that fresh or your vegetables or fruits that you yourself grew or canned, and you know exactly where it came from, and you always have that ability to have that. Even if you don't have tons of money, it's something that is a fairly inexpensive thing to be able to do.
Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Flora is with us next in Wisconsin Dells. Flora, hi.
Hi there. I just recently found kohlrabi, I think that's how it's said, at a farmer's market and had no idea what to do with it. And the guy told me to bake it. We did not like it, but I still had plenty left. So I mixed it with cucumbers, zucchinis, tomatoes, onions, and made a vinaigrette salad. And I had several people ask me what the delightful different taste was in there. So that was a surprise for me.
Yes. Well, that's one of those vegetables that a lot of people are finding in there. If they belong to a CSA, they find these kohlrabis and aren't quite sure what to do with them. So people are asking me frequently about them. But eating them raw in a salad is a great way. They also go well in soup, and like a root vegetable soup. That could be one of your vegetables you could put it in. It's also very kind of creamy in a pureed soup with a cauliflower. That's a nice kind of addition with the kohlrabi.
Flora, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Pedro in Fond du Lac. Pedro, hi.
Hello. So we have apple tree in the backyard, so nothing like apple crisp, like right off of the tree.
Great.
And chili, of course, and soups. And to make your own stock is not hard. Celery, carrots, onions, and bones, and so much better than canned stock.
Pedro, thanks a lot. Soup is on your bucket list, Terry, but making your own stock out of a lot of that great fall produce.
Well, and you have remnants of things when you're creating some of these fall items. So keep those if you're shaving or peeling carrots and parsnips, and you have little rutabaga pieces and scraps. Put everything in a big scrap bowl, and you can add that to your stock and make vegetable stock. I just did a class where we made a corn soup, and we made the corn cobs we made the stock out of, so you used everything from it. And those stocks will freeze great, and if you have a lot of leftover shavings of vegetables, just put them in the freezer in a Ziploc bag for the next time you make stock.
And be ready for your spouse to make fun of you for saving all the garbage
exactly.
from the vegetables.
You know, why is the garbage in the freezer? Because Terry told me to do it.
And Terry, also on your bucket list, not a cooking thing directly, but a fall culinary road trip in Wisconsin. So what kind of things would we schedule on a road trip?
Well, Well, there are so many food-centric things going on in the state. It was hard to pick any specific ones, but I try to kind of highlight things throughout the state and all different things. One of them is already over, but it was my favorite, Beef-A-Rama, which was just in Minocqua this past weekend, where there's an actual parade with beef items and then a big cook-off. There's one of my favorite coming up, though, is the Giant Pumpkin Fest. It's October 3rd and 4th, and I hope I say it correctly, Nicosia. Mm-hmm. And they you can float down the Wisconsin River and hollowed out giant pumpkins. So there's a pumpkin regatta. There's pumpkin bowling. There's also a giant pumpkin drop.
Uh-oh. Sounds
so
messy.
Wear goggles.
Terry, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Terry Milligan, chef, culinary instructor, and food writer. She writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section and has a featured quarterly article in the food magazine Edible Door. That's as in Door County, by the way. With us to talk about her latest piece in the Journal Sentinel, A Culinary Bucket List for Fall. We've got that piece linked on the Central Time Facebook page, and we've got a squash pie recipe on the Central Time website. Check it out. Make it. Bring it on by. Did you see the supermoon lunar eclipse last night? It was looking pretty bad here at first. Cloudy as the moon came up, so I didn't really get to see the supermoon right on the horizon there. But we went over to a lakeshore park, hoping for a clear view, and the clouds cleared just in time to watch the moon start slowly disappearing. The reddish-orangish moon that hung up there for a while was as clear as day. My kids learned a bit about astronomy, I think, and I learned that my cell phone takes really bad pictures of lunar eclipses. But if you got a good picture, share it with us on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet it at @CentralTimeWPR. Total Eclipse of the Moon is a lot of fun, and as we go to the news, a reminder that it's better than certain other kinds of eclipse. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Nothing I can say.